We've got a guest interviewer with us today. His name is Billy Lyer. Fans of the podcast will know Billy because we've interviewed him before. Hi, Billy.
Hi.
You interviewed Deke from Oi Polloi, right?
I did, yeah. We played together in Edinburgh. And
what was it like? Because you've interviewed quite a few people now for your own project on your blog, talking to musicians that you admire and respect. What's it like when you get a chance to meet these people?
Well, I mean, it's great. I mean, so far I interviewed Franz Nicolai, who was in The Hold Steady, Against Me, Leftover Crack, but his solo career is really amazing. And also TV Smith, who was in the adverts in the 70s, like one of the first groundbreaking punk bands, and also been touring by himself ever since.
Okay, so we're gonna kick off the podcast now. Billy, do you want to do the honors?
Sure. So this is an interview I did with Deke from Oi Polloi. They're probably the world's biggest DIY punk band.
Hello, everybody.
It's the multicolored cultural laser. We travel the world for the boys and the girls, casting pots of wonder and amazement. Multicolored cultural laser.
We're a punk band from Edinburgh who've been playing since 1981. We play political punk rock, basically.
And you've been singing for the last several albums entirely in Gaelic as well. How did that come about?
Our last two albums were all in Gaelic. We've always been interested in minority rights and things, and we were just talking about, you hear these stories about sort of tribes in the jungle or whatever, whose culture's been destroyed and their language has been wiped out. We obviously thought that was fairly out of order. And you want to do something about it, but obviously it doesn't make any sense for us to go and learn some language of some Amazonian tribe, you know. So we're kind of great believers in the old thing about thinking globally and acting locally. So we thought, well, what can we do about that where we're based? And being based in Scotland, we've got an indigenous language here that's under threat, which is Gaelic. So we thought, well, the best thing we can do is, if we're a band, if we start doing songs in Gaelic. Problem was, of course, none of us could speak it. We had a friend who's a Gaelic primary school teacher who had learnt Gaelic as well. He used to run a evening class in Edinburgh, Gaelic for Punks, and there was a bunch of us all went and kind of were learning very basic Gaelic. And then basically when we decided we were going to do a record, we told him basically what we wanted to sing about, and he wrote some basic lyrics for us and helped us with the pronunciation. And so we went and recorded this record. But we then thought, it's a bit ridiculous to release something if we can't really stand behind it by being able to speak Gaelic ourselves. So the record had to sit around for a couple of years while I went to college and learned Gaelic. I went up to the Isle of Skye and so on and studied at the Gaelic College there. It was great. And the other guys, for various reasons, didn't have the time and the possibility to actually learn to fluency, but they've all learnt a bit. I think once I felt capable of being able to kind of talk about it on the radio and stuff like that, to justify what we were doing, why we were doing it in Gaelic. I thought, right, we can bring out the record. So we did that and got a good reception and ended up living in the Isle of Lewis for a while as well and working there. And we thought, right, we don't want to make this just a kind of like a novelty one-off record, just, oh, aren't we so cool, we're singing in an endangered language, you know. We really want to put some more weight behind it, create a bit more interest. So we did a full-length album in Gaelic a few years ago. And then when we were doing our last album, we're like, right, we're going to do this in Gaelic as well. I mean, when we play live, we still play lots of songs in English, lots of our old stuff, and except a few times when we played in the Highlands and Islands and we've played an entire set of Gaelic stuff and we speak in Gaelic between the songs. But at the moment, we're writing lots of new stuff. Our new single is one song in English and two songs in Gaelic, and we're doing a new album in the summer, and there's songs in English, Spanish, Swedish, Yiddish, all kinds. I mean, we're interested in languages, you know.
And you tour in a lot of countries. Like, is that ever an issue that you're singing in Gaelic?
Most places we play, people are really enthusiastic and they think it's fairly cool. You know, oh, that's really good. You're doing something to help diversity in your country and hopefully see that an indigenous culture isn't going to die out, isn't going to be wiped out. The only place that we've had a very different reaction is Germany, because people there, because of their history, they're very, very sensitive to anything that they can somehow see as being connected with sort of nationalism. And we think they've really missed the point when we sing in Gaelic. You know, we would say it's about having a diverse, multicultural society having respect for minorities, but they are really, really so sensitive about what happened in the Nazi time that they tend to think, oh, people singing in their own language, wanting this, they must be like really patriotic or something, and then they, which is completely not what it's about. You know, we've had people ask us some very strange questions, like, you burn flags when you play on stage, you burn national flags, and we do, because we don't really believe in nationalism. Patriotism, xenophobia, that kind of thing. So they say, why do you never burn a Gaelic flag? Well, a simple answer to that is there is no such thing as a Gaelic flag. You know, no one is talking about having some kind of Gaelic homeland in the Isle of Lewis or something. You know, it seems funny to us, but we seriously had people in Germany saying,
I've seen
you
some
know,
stuff about that.
You want a Gaelic-speaking fatherland, you know. There isn't even a Gaelic word for fatherland. You try and look it up in the Gaelic online dictionary, and the nearest thing to fatherland is fatal accident inquiry. That's what comes up when you put it in. It's difficult to explain to them, or basically, we're very happy to talk to people, but it's a bit sad when people, they don't really think about it enough. They're not, I don't expect someone to be an expert on Scottish culture and Scottish history and the sort of linguistic situation in Scotland with English and Scots and Gaelic and connection between Scottish Gaelic and Irish Gaelic and so on. That's fair enough if you don't know about that. But don't, from a position of ignorance, start condemning people who are working for linguistic human rights and for protecting minority cultures. We're playing in Germany at the end of the month, and one of our concerts there was cancelled, specifically because of our involvement in Gaelic. Initially, they told us it was because we sung in Gaelic, and when we tried to find out a bit more about what exactly their problem with that was, it became clear that it wasn't so much singing in Gaelic, but campaigning for linguistic diversity and minority cultural rights. You know, they seemed to think, they actually likened us to the German neo-Nazi party, the NPD. They said this was because, you know, we have love of homeland and stuff. Well, you know, if they bothered to actually investigate what the situation is in Scotland and also investigate our previous statements on these kind of subjects, we're not patriotic. We don't want a Gaelic-speaking homeland. We don't want people forced to speak Gaelic. No one does. No one in their right mind does. I've never actually heard of anyone. And we know plenty nutters, obviously, you know, but, you know, some people are very passionate about Gaelic language, but even the most extreme people, no one's ever talked about forcing other people who don't want to learn. The whole point is that if someone does want to learn, the opportunity should be there for them. There's a lot of benefits for children growing up in a bilingual or trilingual situation. It's really good for your mental development, and obviously also for later on learning other languages, and we don't think children should be denied that. If someone wants to learn Indigenous language, as well as basically English is going to be the lingua franca, and that's great, you know, it opens lots of doors as well. But why shouldn't people have both? But a lot of these German people were just, oh, you are wanting Gaelic fatherland and so on. It's utterly, utterly ridiculous. And I think it also, when people talk like that, it shows that they really are probably not aware of their own very privileged situation in having grown up with a language that is the dominant language where they're from. This particular place was in eastern Germany, in an area where there's a minority Slavic language called Sorbish. It was clear from the way these people were talking that there was no one in it. There was the committee in this particular youth cultural centre. There was obviously no one there who was a native Sorbish speaker, no one who was a native Yiddish speaker, or, you know, spoke some Roma language or something. So it's easy for them to sort of dismiss this stuff. And we would say, if you'd been at school and been beaten for speaking your own language, and then being forced to speak another language, or had you, like, your mouth scrubbed out with, like, dishwashing liquid for being caught speaking the language that you spoke at home, I would suggest that you would think rather differently about these issues. I think, you know, these people clearly didn't think about that. They didn't acknowledge their own position of privilege.
SS politician, SS politician.
after studying Gaelic, you ended up working for the BBC. Is that kind of an opposition to being anti-media?
That's a very good question. When I ended up working in the Gaelic TV was because I'd studied a bit of Gaelic at the Gaelic College on Sky, and I basically finished the course, but my Gaelic wasn't as good as I wanted it to be. I was like, how am I going to get it any better? And basically, the best way to learn a language is to be in a situation where you can use it all the time, and you're surrounded by native speakers of the language. Anyone that tries to learn a language by going to an evening class is doomed, I think, unless they're some kind of weird genius. So I think someone once worked out that you need to go to evening classes for 10 years or something. I mean, you can't learn a language that way. You can maybe use it as part of your overall learning thing, but you've got to be with native speakers. And in Scotland, that's difficult because English is everywhere. And there are no monolingual Gaelic speakers left, with the exception of some very young children who haven't gone to school yet, who just speak Gaelic in the home. So basically, you have to go to somewhere where there's a lot of Gaelic speakers and just try and hang out with them as much as possible. And the Gaelic College at that time in Skye offered these other courses to work in television. And when I'd been there previously, just studying basic Gaelic language, we always used to really sneer at the TV students. Like, oh, these wankers are, you know, going to work in the media and stuff. And you would see them, and a lot of them were, clearly, they were sort of young, thrusting media types. I mean, not everyone. There were some really cool people as well. The teaching staff were great. The deal with that was not only did you get free education, but they actually paid you to do it. You got kind of allowance. And you had 1 year studying at the college, and then second year you had a work placement, and they paid you even more money. It was like, fuck, they're going to pay me to learn Gaelic, plus we'll learn some really interesting shit. So I thought, right, I'll go for this. I had no intention of working in TV. Fuck that, you know, fucking media kind of stuff. But, you know, it's a chance to learn and that. So when I'd done the first year, second year I had to decide where you go for a work placement. And the Western Isles is really the Gaelic heartland. So I thought I would go there. And my work placement was with the BBC. I was working on their website. But fairly quickly, I just kept getting asked to go on the radio. There's a sort of morning radio kind of chat show thing. It's a good program. It's really, really popular. But the number of Gaelic speakers in Scotland is very small. It's only about 50,000 or something, you know, like 1% of the population. And it's very heavily skewed towards people who are a lot older. So there's not that many young people. There's also a lot of people from the Western Isles, obviously, Skye and so on, and other parts. People who've grown up in kind of, sort of rural areas that are maybe in some ways, without trying to sound like a patronising dick, they're sort of a bit sheltered. And not terribly much in the way of kind of alternative subcultures and so on. I mean, there are some things. We used to organise, when we lived in Lewis, we would organise punk concerts and bring our mates up from Edinburgh to play, and there were a lot of kids there who were really, really into that and into their metal and thrash metal and so on. Whenever there was a topic that was in any way vaguely alternative, it was difficult for them to find Gaelic speaker to talk about it. So I'd only been in the office about a week, and someone was like, oh, we're having a discussion about legalising cannabis. Maybe, you know, for some reason they thought I might be interested in this, you know, so would you like to come on and talk about it? And so just kind of sort of smiled. But anyway, I got onto that, and then a couple of weeks later, oh, we're having a thing about piercings and that, you know, would you like to talk about, you know, piercings and stuff? And I ended up doing, you know, anything that was vaguely old. I drew the line at reggae one time, because I know nothing about reggae music, basically. I was like, oh, could you talk about reggae? I can't do that. But anyway, it was interesting while I was there. I used to sometimes work having to update stuff on the main Gaelic page, and some of the stuff on there would be to do with the news. This was quite a few years ago, but even then there was the kind of sort of self-censorship going on. But being involved in a Gaelic cultural programme or some kind of Gaelic documentary that isn't about a political subject, we didn't have any problem with that. Be like if someone said, you know, BBC fucking propaganda, let's go and disrupt Bill Oddie's latest programme on ornithology. You know, that's just fairly ridiculous. You know, you're not really hitting the mark. When I first left that BBC work placement thing, I was just going to go to Finland, but I got all these offers to do actual real work. I was like, fuck, a real job. But one of them was working with a small company that did documentaries. It was just a two-person husband and wife thing based in Fife. And they were really cool folk, and we got on really well. It was a sort of DIY outfit, and they were like veggies and right on and everything. But they were working on a really interesting project about Willie Ruff, I think is the guy's name. He's a professor in America who had a really interesting theory about gospel music in the States having been influenced by Gaelic psalm singing from the Western Isles. If anyone hasn't heard Gaelic psalm singing, I would really recommend checking it out. It's really, really strange and beautiful. We're obviously not religious ourselves, but I think you can still appreciate the beauty of this very, very strange way of singing. Anyway, this bloke's theory was that Gaelic speakers who used this particular form had gone over to the States, the Highland Clearances, or just emigrating for other reasons. Obviously, some of them were slave owners. Lots of the slaves spoke Gaelic. They also would have learned the forms of worship of the Gaelic-speaking slave owners. And so this person's theory was that some of the call and response things in Gaelic singing and the Gaelic psalm singing would have influenced some of the slaves. And then he based this on some congregations in the South that did, that still today do singing that sounds vaguely similar. And it was a really interesting theory. There were some people who were very strongly against it and said, no, this is just a coincidence. One of the funny things about that was, after we did that, we made a follow-up program where we got this congregation from the Deep South, was it Tennessee or Alabama or something, I can't remember, but we got them to come over to the Isle of Lewis. And their form of worship, compared with the Wee Frees, you know, the Free Church in the Isle of Lewis, which is very, very strict, you know, even it's the place where you're not allowed to do anything on Sunday apart from go to church. Children's swings are even chained up, so kids can't play on a Sunday and so on. In the church, everything's very staid and serious, and women have to wear dresses and hats and all this kind of thing. Anyway, these folk came over, and basically their pastor or minister or whatever, he was like a cross between Elvis and James Brown. And it was all like, whoa, does the Lord say we're going to praise him? And they'd all shout out, yeah. And you could see these kind of Wee Free people really kind of, what on earth? But because they were kind of fellow Christians, they had to kind of try and be friendly with them. It was really funny. It was really interesting.
You started in the DIY scene, anarchist political punk scene, and that's still happening now, although it's 2014. What do you feel has changed? Has anything changed? Has it got better? Has it got worse?
I think there's two different things you could talk about. If you could talk about how the scene in general has changed, one of the main things, people like ourselves who've been sort of around for, you know, since sort of ancient times or whatever, realizes that technology has changed it drastically. When we first started touring in continental Europe, initially really, and then going to the US and so on, it was so much more difficult to organize tours. We never had the money to phone up people. You know, international phone calls are really, really expensive. Also, I mean, for a while, we didn't all have phones. You know, we may be living in flats where there wasn't a phone. And the same was true of a lot of the people abroad, especially when we first started touring in Eastern Europe. We first went over fairly soon after the wall had come down. You would send a letter to someone, might take a week to get there, might take a week to come back. That's assuming they answered it straight away. So you'd have to start organising tours months in advance, and, you know, letters occasionally went missing, or, you know, if something got cancelled at the last minute, even gigs in Britain, when you'd like organise them by mail, if a gig got cancelled at the last minute, maybe that information wouldn't reach you until it was too late or something. But nowadays, we can organise things in maybe a matter of hours if we're lucky enough that the person we email is online at the time. Obviously, you can also now get your music out to so many people all over the world without having to physically shift big piles of pieces of plastic, which is great in some ways. The downside is that the amount of hard copies of stuff that we can sell has dropped drastically. And for a band like us, that's made things very, very difficult financially. We've never really made much money, but the struggle we have now is getting enough money to pay for recordings. The last two albums, the first one we were only able to finance it because our drummer was very unlucky, sunbathing in the meadows after some festival, and the people were like dismantling all the big tents and things, and a forklift truck that was piled high with, I don't know, boxes of tent pegs or something, didn't see him and drove over him, almost killed him. But he got some medical compensation money, and that financed our album. The album after that, again, we didn't have any money. And we were lucky that we had a friend who ran a studio, and he was prepared to let us record and only pay him once we'd sold some copies and got them. It took us years to pay him back. But not everyone's in those situations, and we find that there's... What happens now is you've got some bands that were already successful, who've got like some record label backing or something, so they can do it. Then you've got other people who just record on a friend's laptop or whatever. That, I mean, we've tried that. We're not happy with the results, basically. It's okay for a sort of rough and ready demo and that, but it's not what we want to do. We want to make something a bit better than that. We're kind of sort of stuck in the middle. You know, we've got offers all the time for loads of gigs. It's always a struggle to break even. And one of the things that we've been doing for years is, if we don't quite cover all our costs, you know, we sell a bunch of CDs and that'll fill up the gap, especially where it's a benefit concert and we'd like to play for as cheaply as possible. Nowadays, we find that's a lot more difficult. So it means we can play less concerts. We tend to have to play in bigger cities where there's bigger crowds and we can get more money. So we can't play in a lot of these rural places that we would have liked to. We can't play so many benefit gigs for free. We used to do lots of gigs for free in Edinburgh because all the money could go straight to the Autonomous Centre or whatever. The last few years we've played gigs in Edinburgh and we've had to take the money for recording costs or covering our losses or something. So, you know, on the one hand, yeah, it's great, you can get all the music for free, but there is a cost, and that cost is maybe some other places that are worthwhile not getting that money, and us maybe not being able to play in more sort of far-flung, outlying places. Talking specifically about how the political side of things has changed, one thing I think things have improved very greatly is in terms of stuff like vegetarianism and veganism. When we first started touring in Europe, I think the first year we went was 1988, and a lot of places we went, when we mentioned that, oh, can we have vegetarian, vegan food, people just looked at us like we were crazy, especially in a lot of these political squats in places like Holland, Belgium, Germany. People would just kind of sort of laugh and oh, isn't that cute? You're worried about little fluffy animals. We don't have time to worry about stuff like that. We're too busy defending our squats from the cops and fighting the fascists and so on. And our whole thing would be, it's not an either-or thing. Everything's interconnected. You know, we're great believers in the animal liberation, human rights, one struggle, one fight, that it's all connected. But even if you didn't believe that, there's still no reason not for eating a cruelty-free and more healthy diet. We now find that vegan food is pretty much standard almost everywhere we play, which is brilliant, you know. And it's also had another kind of effect that we've never, as a band, had a policy of, we're not going to have anyone in the band if they eat meat. I mean, it turned out that virtually everyone has been veggie or vegan. But there's been occasions when, you know, someone's left the band and we're looking for a replacement, where someone who has come up as a replacement has been a meat eater. And our basic thing is, we would rather have someone in the band who we think is a good person than someone who's maybe, oh, totally correct, and but might be a bit of a wanker. And let's face it, these people do exist, you know. So we're not going to say, oh, you can only be in our band if you're vegan, you know, even if you're a fucking tosser. but someone who really thinks cool, you know, might not be in the band because they hate me. Because on the occasions when this has happened, the reasons that they've been meat eaters are probably because they've maybe come from a slightly different scene and they've not really been exposed to these ideas so much and thought about it so much. And our basic position on the couple of occasions when this has happened has been, we think if they come on tour with us and get delicious vegan food every night for like a month and a half, odds are they're going to become at the very least veggie. And that's exactly what happened both times. So that's a very positive development.
Billy Lyre, everybody, and Deke from Oi Polloi. Billy Lyre, thank you so much for going out and getting that interview, and do pass our appreciation on to Deke, please.
I will do.
We should say also, if people want to go out and catch Oi Polloi live, where can they find them?
They're playing next in Glasgow at the Classic Grand on the 4th of July, and then Aberdeen at the Tunnels on the 5th of July. And they're also playing in the regular, like, Crammond Island of Punk at the beginning of August.
Oh, the great Crammond Island secret.
Totally DIY, totally free.
Terrifying, but brilliant.
Terrifying and brilliant, yeah. Punks on an island in the middle of the sea.
We're going to close the podcast today with a song from Oi Polloi, of course. If you don't get a chance to go and see them live in Glasgow or Aberdeen, check out their webpage. It's at oipolloi.org.
You can buy their newest album. It's called Dushk.
And we're going to finish the podcast with a song from that album. It's called...
Linux.
Or Linux, an ode to open source, obviously. Oi Polloi, everybody.